May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Connors with the firm of Marshall Dennehy, Warner, Coleman & Goggin. I'm here on behalf of my client, Clariant Corporation, to request in our appeal the reversal of the lower court's decision requiring Clariant to defend and indemnify Mill Pond Properties, to seek affirmance of that portion of the court's decision below, determining that Clariant Corporation did not act in bad faith or breach an implied covenant of fair dealing, good faith and fair dealing, in deciding to cease paying for Mill Pond's defense after certain events occurred. Your Honors, the genesis of this case begins with an incident that occurred back in May of 2003 when an individual named Rocky Staton, who was employed by my client, Clariant Corporation, was pulling a pelletizer at premises that Clariant Corporation rented from Mill Pond. This pelletizer was very heavy, and basically what he did was he pulled it towards him over a crack in the floor, and he pulled it on top of him. This piece of equipment weighed 1,700 pounds, and it crushed his leg. As a result, Mr. Staton brought a lawsuit against Mill Pond and its president, Joseph Warnell, alleging negligence in maintenance, repair, and inspection of the floor because of the existence of the crack. They also sued other parties that are not important to the matters at hand.
Just for purposes of factual background, the defect in the floor, if it's of sufficient size to cause this machine to topple, it is obviously, or is it obvious that it's visible?
It is visible, Your Honor. It's also located very close to what would be a natural concrete seam between the concrete sections of the floor. So
the reference to a latent defect, perhaps what's underneath is latent, but the defect in the floor was obviously visible.
You could certainly see the crack, but there was a question below as to whether this machine was caught in that crack or whether it was actually caught in the simple natural seam that you see between normal sections of sidewalk pavement. Your Honor, Mill Pond filed an answer, and in that answer to the complaint included a third-party complaint against my client, Clarion Corporation. The way they paraphrased the claim was that Mill Pond was entitled to a defense and indemnity. But they quote a lease provision improperly. They say that we were obligated to defend or indemnify Mill Pond even for the conduct of the landlord, and that's not the case, as can be seen in paragraph 15A of the lease upon which they relied.
Well, is it fair to say that the first lawsuit was about who was primarily liable, the landlord or the tenant, for the injury of the third party?
Actually, it was not, Your Honor, because the claim was bifurcated at trial. And basically what happened in the underlying...
Well, that was an issue, was it not?
My client believed that it was for a time, Your Honor, based upon the original complaint. But there was a sea change.
Well, before we get to the sea change, the original complaint led to a third-party complaint that brought into the dispute the insurers.
My client, Clariant, which happened to be plaintiff's employer, they brought in... Well, I'm not sure whether you're talking about the underlying tort action or the...
I'm talking about the first lawsuit.
The first declaratory judgment action?
Correct.
Okay. That came about, Your Honor, as a result of the pre-existing tort incident.
The underlying injury.
Yes, and...
And the question was, which was it the landlord's liability or the tenant's? And there was a dispute between each of them based on the lease provision as to who was primarily liable, and that brought in, by way of third-party complaint, the insurers. I'm just asking this question as background.
Right, that's not correct, Your Honor. In the underlying tort
action...
What is
correct?
The only parties that were involved in the first declaratory judgment action were Ms. Sherlock's clients, Mill Pond and Hartford, and my client, Clariant and its insurance carrier.
So the insurance carriers were involved?
In the DJ actions, absolutely, Your Honor.
All right. Okay. So the answer to my question is yes. Which parties to the lease were liable, and were their insurers obligated to provide a defense in that regard?
The question was a duty to
is
defend,
that right?
Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, duty to defend and indemnify.
And that lawsuit was eventually settled?
It was resolved, Your Honor.
It was settled, was it not?
By way of a settlement agreement and general release.
All right. And then a second lawsuit was filed, and that's the one before us.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that second lawsuit was also filed by Mill Pond?
And its carrier, yes.
And it arose out of the same personal injuries?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the issue, one of the issues, is whether that second lawsuit was foreclosed by the settlement in the first lawsuit?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the trial court held that it was not?
The trial court held that it was not.
Because a new cause of action had been alleged?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, if... in fact, or in law, the second lawsuit had been foreclosed as a consequence of that settlement, whether because of res judicata or release, would that moot the other issues that are raised on this appeal?
I think it would, Your Honor.
All right.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think those are certainly key issues, and in that first declaratory judgment action, there was a settlement agreement and general release. And it was a general release in every way, shape, or form.
And under that settlement agreement, your client was to pay the defense costs?
Now, Your Honor, under that, those are not the terms in the settlement agreement and general release. We paid for some past defense costs. Mill Pond agreed to execute the general release. Also agreed to execute a stipulation of dismissal with prejudice. My client opted to pay Mill Pond's defense costs going forward. There's nothing in that release that obligated us to do so. And, more importantly, there's nothing in that general release that that required us to pay defense costs indefinitely.
Well, did the first declaratory judgment action put in issue past and future payment of defense costs and indemnification?
Your Honor, I think it did. I think it did. And by that I mean the resolution of that matter basically foreclosed Hartford and Mill Pond from coming back to Clariant for any future defense costs, because the release specifically states that it releases and discharges all claims that related to the defense of Mill Pond in the Staten case.
Now, you say there's a dispute about what the release contemplated or the settlement agreement contemplated. Has that been adjudicated?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that there is. I don't think that there is a dispute as to what it contemplated. What the release states as a general release is that Hartford and Mill Pond agreed in exchange for payment of about $5,000 in past defense costs to release my client, Clariant, and its carrier from all future defense costs, all claims, including claims for indemnity, that arose out of the Staten action and the defense of Mill Pond.
That was for $6,500?
That was for $6,500.
And did that settlement encompass, that is, involve some sort of promise on your client's part to continue to pay the defense costs?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing in writing.
But your client did pay those costs for a time.
They elected, they opted to, on their own decision, to pay.
On their own decision, out of the kindness of their heart?
No, Your Honor, there's a letter that that explains that. It was written by Clarion's in-house counsel to Ms. Sherlock, basically saying that we opted to pay those because under the original complaint, they believed that the allegations against Mill Pond related to a simple crack in the floor.
Well, I just want to know why, if your client had no further obligation to pay a cent beyond that $6,500, they continue to pay the cost of the defense until they decided not to.
No, that's what I was getting at, Your Honor. They believe that looking at the original complaint, the allegations in the original complaint, we're asking Milpon to respond to a failure to repair a simple crack. And under the lease, it believed at that time that it might have some obligations. However, then there was a sea change in the posture of the case with, A, the filing of an amended complaint, which was supported by an expert theory that changed the whole nature of the complaint.
Can I interrupt you? Because clearly that's going on to another issue. We know that it's your position that there was a sea change, and that's not necessarily a universal position. But I'm still confused about where the first declaratory judgment and the settlement of that judgment left everybody, because there was a declaratory judgment that was brought to determine who has the obligation to defend and indemnify, correct?
The first one and the second one, yes, Your Honor.
Well, but I want to deal with just the first one for now. And when that case was resolved by a settlement and release, what was your client's obligation per the settlement of that declaratory judgment action?
I don't think it had any agreed-to obligation. It voluntarily decided.
Wait a second. Don't tell me what happened. I just want to know what you think the settlement did in terms of legal obligations of the parties. And you're saying that your client, Clarient, and its insurer had no further obligation with respect to the Staten action to provide a defense or to indemnify Milpon.
That's correct, because those claims were released in the settlement agreement.
Okay. And in exchange for that release and settlement and all that, your client paid about $6,000.
Right? Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. But the Staten action is still going on. So my next question.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So my next question becomes, having resolved the issue between the two insurance carriers as to who was going to be stepping forward, why did you continue to pay for Milpon's defense after that?
Well, Your Honor, the issue was not settled as to which of the insurance carriers, Hartford or American Home, was going to pay for the continuing defense. That issue is not addressed in the settlement agreement that Hartford and Milpon signed.
Well, what did the settlement agreement address?
Past settlement costs and an agreement to dismiss my client from all future defense costs arising out of the Staten case, the defense of Milpon in the Staten case.
Well, your defense would be undertaken by your insurance carrier, right?
No, there was a $1 million
okay.
retention, so that would not happen. And Judge
okay.
Whitcomb determined that they have no obligation to defend
Fine.
Or indemnify.
Fine, okay. So let's leave the insurers out of it for the moment. You sign an agreement that says, I've now been relieved. Clarient has now been relieved of any obligation to defend on behalf of Milpon, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you got a general release in
correct.
Addition. But the next day, you're in there defending Milpon, right?
The next day, Your Honor, we were paying for their defense costs going forward, but without any agreement that we were to continue to do so because, Your Honor, things can change in a lawsuit, and they did in this case.
Okay, but I want to get to before anything changed. Would you explain to me why Clarient continued to defend after signing a release and a stipulated dismissal of a case where it says explicitly you have no further obligation to defend Milpon?
It doesn't say that we have no further obligation. It simply says that they release us from all future claims, which essentially should have dropped the third-party complaint against us out of the Staten case.
And you so argued.
And I so
and
argued.
And the court ruled against you.
Correct, Your Honor. And I so argued, and we acted as a responsible party by looking at what was in the complaint, We opted to pay based upon our parents' belief that what was alleged in the original complaint may implicate our duty to defend and indemnify under the lease. That's why we did it, Your Honor. However, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I'm just saying you're into your rebuttal time, which you can use or save.
I understand, Your Honor. That's why we elected to do that. But we didn't agree ever to continue to do so, because things did change in the case. There was an amendment to the complaint. There was an expert report that supported that new theory. There were also additional theories that plaintiff brought against Mill Pond, which were active concealment and affirmative misrepresentation, which we clearly have no duty to defend or indemnify them against under the terms of the lease. And also, eventually, the court below rendered certain decisions that basically wiped out of Staten's case against Mill Pond any claims that we might even remotely have an obligation to defend and indemnify them for. In fact, what really went to trial in the Staten case were claims of active concealment and affirmative misrepresentation, and the defendants prevailed on that. What is also important, Your Honor, is after the first amended complaint was filed, Mill Pond answered that complaint, but they never filed another third-party complaint asking for defense costs and indemnification costs against Clariant, from Clariant, on these new claims. And I think that's important, because to bring an employer, to make a claim against an employer, you have to bring them into the case under a contract. That's the only way you can bring them in under Delaware law. I only have 3 minutes left, Your Honor, so I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Please the court, Mary Sherlock from Weber Gallagher, Simpson, Stapleton, Fires, and Newby, on behalf of the appellees and cross appellants, Mill Pond Properties and Hartford Mutual Insurance Company. This is not a coverage case. This is about a contract. This case is about a commercial lease entered into between a non-possessory landlord, Mill Pond, and its tenant, Clariant Corporation.
Ms. Sherlock, yes. Let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Conner.
Yes,
one of the issues that was raised below and is on appeal is whether the settlement of the first declaratory judgment action foreclosed the second declaratory judgment action, which is before us now. Is it correct, as Mr. Conner conceded, that if the second lawsuit was foreclosed, whether by operation of res judicata or the release or some combination of both, that all of the other issues on this appeal would be mooted?
No, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. The reason being is at the time that release was executed and the stipulation of dismissal was filed in January of 2008, from the first declaratory judgment action, Ms. Mansovinas from Marks O'Neill was still defending Mill Pond, and they were still being paid by Clariant to the
I'm
tune
sorry,
of
you're giving
20-
me a factual answer. Give me a legal one. Why, if the second lawsuit was barred, let's assume that it was barred,
okay.
Is there anything left to the issues that are being argued on appeal?
Yes, the issue of who's going to defend Mill Pond and who's going to pay Mill Pond's defense costs.
That issue remains even if the settlement foreclosed the second action?
Yes, Your Honor.
But there would be no action going forward and therefore nothing to defend.
The underlying Staten action was going forward, Your Honor.
And that wasn't resolved?
AIG had retained Ms. Mansovina specifically to defend Mill Pond's interests. She was an attorney of record in the case.
Well, let's take a look at the settlement agreement, because it is a general release, is it not?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay. And the parties that are doing the releasing are your client, Mill Pond, and Hartford.
Yes.
Mill Pond's insurance company. And they're releasing Clariant and American Home Insurance, right?
Correct.
And what they're releasing them from are all claims, causes of action. I'm just quoting here from the selectively from this settlement agreement. Past, present, and future, known or unknown, asserted or unasserted, whether or not ascertainable at the time of execution, arising out of the defense of, and then the case that's cited is the first declaratory judgment action.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, that to me looks like it encompasses everything. And there was a defense raised that this settlement agreement and release foreclosed your second declaratory judgment action.
Yes, if I may address, John, that first declaratory judgment action was brought after the defense had been tendered, after a year and a half of letters and waiting for the defense to be tendered.
So what?
In that first action, what?
So what?
Because
it's a broad release that seems to encompass the universe. What
all the remedies that the plaintiffs were seeking in that first declaratory judgment action had been achieved. Clariant had agreed to provide a defense, had retained Ms. Mansovina. She had entered her appearance.
Now, wait. The first action was resolved by settlement. There was a release that was executed in the broadest terms. Your client then turns around and files a second lawsuit.
Yes, Your Honor, because
arising out of the very same personal injury.
Well, no, that's where Judge Witham was correct. It's not the same action.
Mr. Staten was injured twice.
Milpont and Hartford Mutual, Your Honor, in due respect, could not anticipate that within 2 months of signing this release and agreeing to provide a defense, that they would yet again breach the terms of the lease and refuse unilaterally to provide a defense.
Okay. I'm sorry, you're saying that there was a breach of the settlement agreement and it wasn't operative?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the court rule on that claim?
Implicitly, it did, Your Honor. The court
implicitly,
below...
I didn't see anything in the opinion that even addressed that. Did you raise it below?
Yes, Your Honor. The court did not directly address the issue of release. The court did address the issue of res judicata and found, similarly, same argument, that it did not apply because the amended complaint and the underlying case asserted new theories.
It was a different cause of action.
New cause of action.
But does that legally matter? Whereas here, the release encompasses all causes of action, past, present, and future.
Yes,
and
Your
Honor. Your second declaratory judgment simply alleged what would be at best a future cause of action.
Yes, I've provided the court with a Superior Court case of Panetta versus Steinberg, in which a similar situation occurred, where there was a settlement and then there was a breach. And Judge Durden ruled in that case that to hold that a general release would bar a plaintiff's claim would allow a defendant to carte blanche commit future wrongdoing against the plaintiff. And she cited Williston that a general release encompasses claims unknown, cannot possibly encompass claims unknown at the time of execution.
Your position on the settlement agreement is that the other side agreed to pay the defense costs and to indemnify, and that was the consideration, or at least part of the consideration, for the release. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, has a court upheld that point of view?
Yes, the court has. The court has agreed that there is...
Not that there's a new cause of action,
yes,
but that the settlement agreement involved an actual agreement between your client and the other side to pay the defense costs and to indemnify you. And has a court adjudicated that fact?
No, quite honestly, Your Honor, the underlying court did not address that. It did not interpret the release.
Well, isn't that your remedy if there is a full and general release in consideration of a settlement agreement? You can't do anything but enforce the settlement agreement, correct?
Correct. I guess our position is that there was a completely new cause of action, a new breach of contract, new breach of the lease, new allegations of bad faith, and that's why the second declaratory judgment action was brought. We couldn't anticipate that they would unilaterally just stop defending and paying the cost of defense.
And you argued that in your brief before
yes.
us.
Yes.
But it was not the subject of any adjudication by the trial court.
Well,
that is, in effect, it's out there, but we don't have anything to review as to whether that's right or not. So how are we supposed to address that? We don't have any adjudication that there was a breach of the settlement agreement. All we have is the settlement agreement, and it's very broad. So, and it's broad enough to cover even a new cause of action arising out of the same facts that underlie the first declaratory judgment action. So why is it not the case that your second declaratory judgment action, which is generating this appeal, is foreclosed, should not have gone forward?
The release and the res judicata were raised as affirmative defenses. They were argued by Clariant in the underlying Staten case, and Judge Witham did not grant them summary judgment on that issue. He found that res judicata, as a matter of law, did not apply.
It may be that res judicata doesn't apply because there was no judicata. That is, it was a settlement without an adjudication of liability. But there was still a final judgment and a release, that was executed in the broadest terms. So, you know, even if it isn't res judicata, why doesn't the defense of release foreclose your second action?
Well, Your Honor, there's case law that the court can look outside the four corners of the release and look at the intent of the parties. Again, all the remedies that the plaintiff sought in that first declaratory judgment action had been achieved. There was no reason not to enter into a settlement. Milpon was now being provided with a defense at Clariant's cost. Milpon had been reimbursed all of its defense costs. In hindsight, I wish we had gotten a ruling the first time around. But we thought we had an understanding by the actions of Clariant that they were going to continue to defend. Now, there was no limitations in that release as to how long or any qualifications.
And you're saying that was consideration for the release?
Yes, Your Honor.
And apparently there's documents or evidence to support that?
There is a letter from Mr. Connors to me saying that we will tender the defense. We are accepting the tender of defense. We're just waiting for your costs, your defense costs, in the underlying case. In hindsight, perhaps that really sort of spelled out a little bit more in detail what was being agreed to. But by the intent of the parties, given the fact it was a declaratory judgment action, and by the actions of Clariant and the parties, it seemed...
But you agree that at least in front of us this morning, that both sides cannot agree on what the intent of the parties was?
You cannot agree looking at the four corners of the document.
The other side says they have no obligation to defend in the future. You're saying they did.
No one has
adjudicated that yet.
They continued to defend for 7 months, incurring $23,000 more in attorney's fees from Ms. Mansovinos. There's a letter from Mr. Jordan to Ms. Mansovinos breaking down those costs of $23,000. It's in the record acknowledging.
So they're saying they did that for reasons other than the settlement agreement, correct?
They did it because of the settlement agreement.
But I know that that's your position. But their position is that they're doing that for different reasons. Didn't we just hear that this morning?
I'm not sure why, out of the goodness of their heart, they would agree to continue to defend and continue to pay $23,000 in defense costs.
All right, maybe we can go at it a different way. Can you point to the language in the settlement agreement of the first declaratory judgment action that says that Clariant will continue to defend and indemnify Milpon? Is that in the settlement agreement?
No, it is not in there. It's not in the agreement. It's in letters between counsel, and it's in the fact of what the complaint for declaratory judgment was for. I mean, this isn't a personal injury action where somebody's trying to just get some money from an automobile accident. This was asking the court to declare that they had a duty to defend and a duty to reimburse for defense costs. And again, they did agree to that.
Here's the problem I'm having. If the whole dispute between the parties in terms of the declaratory judgment action was who's got the obligation to defend and indemnify, and you're saying it was Clariant, right? And that's why you bring the declaratory judgment action, right?
Yes, under the terms of the lease. Yes.
Okay. And the two sides have differing views on that, but then they reach a settlement. And the settlement says nothing about Clariant having a duty to defend going forward, right?
Well, Your Honor, they really didn't have different views on that because after the defense was tendered, AIG retained Mr. Connors to represent the interests of them, and nothing happened. It's clear that...
Forget what did or didn't happen. What I'm trying to find out is what the terms of the settlement agreement provided for. And you're saying the settlement agreement didn't say anything about who's got the future obligation to defend. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was.
But that was the whole point of the declaratory judgment action, was to determine who's got the obligation to defend, right? So you file an action and then you settle it without resolving the question that you filed it for?
I should have put it in the release, Your Honor. I assumed in good faith by the fact that they had retained counsel that had for the last 7 months been representing Milpon, defending the underlying case, was paying her defense costs.
So is it your position that the settlement release and the documents should be reformed in some way to reflect a agreement to defend and indemnify in the future?
Yes, I would say so, because I believe that was what was implied by the actions of the parties.
But again, that an action for reformation or a claim for reformation has not been filed anywhere.
No, Your Honor. There would have been no motivation for us to resolve the first one if it was just pay us our $6,500 back in defense costs and we buy peace in the case.
So it was an important ingredient in the settlement.
Yes.
This obligation to pay defense costs.
Yes.
So important that it wasn't put into the settlement agreement and there's no reference to it.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor, in hindsight. Which is why after they again breached the lease, terms of the lease, by unilaterally refusing to defend.
All right, well, let's stop there because, that seems to be critical to your response to the release defense. That is that there was a failure of consideration, which was, what the release was bargained for. But on its face, and if you've conceded in response to Justice Berger's question, there's no reference at all to the ongoing obligation to defend your client. So if the release is valid on its face, it would basically foreclose the second declaratory judgment action, correct? That
yes,
is, if you had no opportunity to somehow litigate this question of failure of consideration, then the issue would basically be determined as a matter of law in the four corners of this release. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. The release says claims known and unknown.
And so for your failure of consideration argument to be considered, and I'm basically asking the same question that Justice Ridgely did, you would in effect have to file some sort of a motion or claim to reform the release based on parole evidence of what was really agreed to. Is that right?
Yes, and in essence, the release, my understanding of the intent of the parties.
No reformation motion was filed and no evidence was put into the record to support your side's contention that there was a failure of consideration. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, because we could not have anticipated what they were going to do. Once they subsequently breached it, it wasn't an existing claim. You can't anticipate at the time of settlement that someone is going to turn around and again breach an agreement. This is a breach of an agreement, and when that occurred, the second declaratory judgment action was filed. At the time it was executed, we couldn't anticipate a subsequent breach. It's not the same claim. It's not the same loss. They tried to argue in their briefs that if you look at the first declaratory judgment action and the second, they mirror each other. Well, they don't. The second declaratory judgment action clearly talks about the first settlement, the first declaratory judgment action, how they again now unilaterally were breaching the agreement, were again in bad faith, were again breaching the lease. It's not the same action. I think it would be awfully harsh.
Well, again, you're saying that they're breaching the agreement and that you specifically alleged that in the second declaratory judgment action.
I did, Your Honor.
But was that addressed by the Superior Court? Was there a ruling that there was a breach?
In all honesty, there was not.
Well, all right. So we're back to, again, our earlier inquiry. There's been no adjudication on the scope of the settlement agreement or any breach.
Yes. Just the court only ruled on the res judicata issue. If I may just summarize, I just wanted to spend a minute on our cross appeal. The cross appeal is for breach of implied covenant and good faith dealing. When one looks throughout this entire case and the underlying case, that is what existed. There was a lease that had an insurance provision that required the landlord to provide insurance, that required the landlord to name the tenant as an additional name insured. That was done. The good faith dealing and the fruits of the bargain were that a defense would be provided. As soon as the underlying case was filed, the defense was tendered, letters went unignored, and finally the first declaratory judgment action had to be filed to force their hand. It succeeded. They agreed finally to do what they were obligated to do under the lease and under their insurance policy. They assumed the defense. They paid the defense costs, and they continued to defend until they alleged this amended complaint changed their obligation.
The trial judge did address the bad faith claim and found that both sides had a colorable basis to take the positions that they did.
Well, Your Honor, he said colorable position in regards to the denial of indemnity. He did not indicate that there was a basis to deny defense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Can I start with a quick hypothetical?
Yes, Your Honor.
After the first settlement, the first declaratory judgment action and the settlement and the release, I'm correct that Clarent continued to provide a defense, right?
Up to a point.
Okay. Let's assume for a moment that there was no amended complaint and no new claims, whether they were new or crystallizing anything or whatever. Just nothing new happened, and this case plodded along to trial and whatever the litigation expenses were, they were. If nothing else had happened, would it be Clarence's position that it was under an obligation to provide a defense and to indemnify Mill Pond in that action?
I can't answer that, Your Honor, because I don't know how the evidence would come out.
Well,
first of all, Your Honor, we are not an insurance carrier, and we don't have the same duties as an insurance carrier does.
What I'm trying to get at is some rational explanation of why you continued to defend on behalf of Mill Pond after you signed an agreement that it looks like said you were being released of that obligation.
We continued, as I said earlier, Your Honor, we continued to do so because we believe that what was in the original complaint as it stood implicated our defense and indemnity costs for certain claims that were in the original complaint. But that changed completely. And there were a number of things that started that change. The amended complaint, the expert report, then the addition of other claims by plaintiff against Mill Pond, and then the court's decisions. There are two December 30th, 2008 decisions, which, as I alluded to earlier, basically wiped out every single claim. Duty to repair and inspect, duty to fix latent defects, any conceivable claim that we would have a duty to defend and indemnify
Isn't the scope of the settlement agreement directly relevant to the validity of the bad faith claim? I mean, doesn't a tribunal have to know what your settlement or decide what your settlement agreement actually was before it can determine if post-settlement agreement there was bad faith?
Your Honor, I don't think that a bad faith claim can be brought against the tenant. This is a lease-based dispute. If anything, it's a breach of implied covenant. The only thing that can be alleged is breach of implied faith, implied good faith and fair dealing.
All right. Well, to determine that breach, don't you have to understand, a court doesn't it have to understand what the settlement agreement was?
I think that the settlement agreement is objectively clear on its face. And I think that what the Superior Court did in deciding in my client's favor that we did not breach any such duty was that we had legitimate bases upon which to cease our payment of Milpon's defense costs after all these changes occurred. And Your Honor, we don't stand in the shoes of an insurance carrier. We are a party that bargained at arm's length.
I understand
our
point.
Landlord.
Thank you. Your time is up. We appreciate counsel's arguments, and
thank
we'll
you, Your Honor.
Take the matter under advisement.